Our next speaker is Damon D'Ambrosio with his presentation entitled Improved Understanding of Seed Treatment Performance Through Knowledge of Local Levels of Neonicotinoid Resistance. Thank you.
All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. And I'd like to talk to you all today about how we can really better interpret efficacy of seed treatments when we know basically the resistance background of the insect we're working with. And I'd like to do it in the context of tobacco thrips and neonic seed treatments. So I'll start out with a little bit of quick background about thrips and cotton, how seed treatments play into controlling thrips and cotton, and then the issue of resistance we're starting to see with these treatments. From there, I have two examples from my PhD work that talk about, or I hope demonstrate, how knowing the background of these populations can really better inform our results. From there, I'll comment briefly on how we can better understand resistance from a multiple AI approach. And I'll demonstrate what we can or really can't glean from knowing a geographic distribution of resistance. And then I'll finish up with some concluding remarks. So the tobacco thrip, Sprinkling Yellow Fusca, is an early season pest of cotton. It afflicts the plant from roughly emergence to 4 to 5 true leaf stage. And damage from the thrips directly damages the seedling. And in certain cases, it can disrupt apical dominance, and that can lead to yield loss. In really severe instances, it can kill the plant outright. And what we use really to control these are neonicotinoid seed treatments, basically two AIs, imidacloprid and thiamethoxam. So in 2013 or so, we started to hear reports of subsatisfactory performance of seed treatments in cotton-producing areas in the southeast and mid-south. And our lab group undertook a fairly widespread survey of these populations in 2014 and 2015. And what we were able to detect was that we have resistance to both AIs. Now, this figure up here demonstrates that. We have two maps. Each point on the map represents a thrips population that was screened, and the size of the point represents survivorship. The larger the point, the more survivorship we saw in our assay. And on the left here, you can see imidacloprid, and on the right, thiamethoxam. So as you can see, we do see it with both AIs. So if we think about it, when we're talking with these two AIs, we can really have four resistance phenotypes with our thrips population. And I have those listed here along with the frequency with which we detect them in North Carolina. The first is susceptible, which as you can guess would be sensitivity to both thiamethoxam and imidacloprid. And roughly 23% of our populations we've encountered demonstrate that phenotype. The second is an imidacloprid resistant phenotype. So we see resistance to imidacloprid, but not to thiamethoxam. Roughly 11% of our populations demonstrate that. Third is thiamethoxam resistant, which is thiamethoxam resistance, but not imidacloprid resistance, roughly 12% of our populations. And then finally, the majority of our populations are cross-resistant, or they exhibit some resistance to both AIs, and 54% or so of our populations have demonstrated that. So we look at these different types, and we kind of start thinking, the different responses and difference in performance we see throughout the region. Could it be in part because of this varying resistance phenotype? And we're also seeing increased evidence that crops outside of cotton are somewhat responsible for the development of resistance as well. So that kind of got us the question, how do these differences that we see in resistance phenotype impact the control from the seed treatments? And so I'd like to start off with an example. This is a greenhouse trial I conducted last year. And what we did was take a field population from Weldon, North Carolina, which is a cotton-producing region in the state, and we compared that to our laboratory susceptible population. Now we set up, you can see at the bottom right here, multiple insect-proof cages where we grew plants individually in them. And we staggered our planting so we can get three plant ages that roughly bookended when we'd expect a cotton plant to be susceptible, getting back at that 4 to 5 true leaf stage I was talking about. So we plant them, they come of age, we release 5 thrips on each of them, and we would put or we allow the thrips to interact 10 days on the plant, and then after that we would harvest the plant and wash them, and we can make an assessment of how well the larval population was able to establish on these plants. So we took a subset of that population before we started, and we ran a multiple-dose diet-based bioassay to get an idea of the resistance background of our populations. And I have those reported here. For our laboratory-susceptible population, we have an LC50 of roughly 9 parts per million for thiamethoxam, and for imidacloprid, roughly 6 parts per million. Now, our field-resistant population, we see a LC50 of 169 parts per million for thiamethoxam, which is roughly 19-fold more resistant than our lab-susceptible. And for imidacloprid, we had a resistance background, an LC50 of 87 parts per million, which is about 15 times more resistant than our laboratory-susceptible. For the sake of simplicity today, I'm going to report this data as this equation you see at the bottom, the proportion of larvae recovered, which is in essence the number of larvae we find on a treated seedling divided by the number we find on an untreated seedling. So as you approach or exceed one, you're demonstrating an erosion of control for any particular treatment. So this is what that looks like for our susceptible population, and I've highlighted one in the light gray dotted line. So as these lines approach that, or these treatment lines approach that dotted line, we can make the assessment that we're losing control over time. So we see for thymethoxam a pretty substantial decrease in efficacy as the plants get older. A very slight one in imidacloprid, not anywhere near the level we see in thymethoxam in the older plants. We can compare that to our resistant population, and as we can see, there's a very different response here. We see degradation with both, but with imidacloprid especially, there's a lot of degradation. And in fact, at some point between 24 and 29 days, we lose effective control of this compound. So pretty simply put, we see complete erosion in a population that's 15-fold resistant to imidacloprid, which I think it makes sense. A second example I'd like to show you is from a field trial we conducted at Rocky Mount over the summer, Rocky Mount, North Carolina, which is in a cotton-producing area in the state. We did it on a research station. And similar to how we did with the greenhouse trial, we took an assessment of our local thrips population before we began to process data. To do that, we harvested a subset of our seedlings. We were able to extract thrips larvae from them. We were then able to rear those up in the lab and perform a bioassay to get an idea of what we're dealing with in this field trial. And for this population, we have an LC50 of 205 parts per million for thymethoxam, which, thinking back to our lab susceptible population from the previous example, is about 23-fold resistant. For imidacloprid, 27 parts per million, which is roughly 5-fold resistant. And similar to the greenhouse trial, for simplicity, I'm going to report it as the percent larvae recovered. So this is what that data looks like at 27 days after plant. For this example, we only have this one post-treatment or post-planting date. And you can see there's a marked difference in performance between thymethoxam and imidacloprid, which if we think back to our profile, a resistance profile we established, that seems to make sense. So thymethoxam does not perform well against a population that we know to be thymethoxam resistant. So that leads us to better understanding this resistance in thrips. And really, a complete understanding of resistance, relies on knowing the response to multiple active ingredients. If we think about it, resistance that we see is not AI-specific. It's not necessarily a thymethoxam problem that's evolving to a imidacloprid problem. We see issues with both. And secondly, and similarly, the efficacy, if you see efficacy against one compound in a population, it doesn't mean that the population is susceptible overall. It's very possible for a population to be resistant to thymethoxam, let's say, but not resistant to imidacloprid, or vice versa. And so to really interpret and know our resistance background of a thrips population when we're assaying it in any trial, we need to know the status to both of those, and I think that really speaks to the value of preliminary laboratory screenings. Like I demonstrated in the two examples, whether you're taking a subset out of the field of the thrips you expect to encounter, administer that diet-based assay to them, or some type of assay to gain an idea of resistance to both AIs, and then you have more context for understanding your results in these trials. So I'd like to kind of wrap it up here. This is a map of the geographic distribution of the resistance phenotypes that we see. Each point on this map represents a population that was sampled in North Carolina. And the colors denote the phenotype that we see. So red dots up here are cross-resistant populations, resistance to both AIs. Orange dots are imidacloprid-only resistant. The light green dots are thymethoxam-only resistant. And then the blue dots are susceptible to both AIs. What I'd like to point out here is there's really no evident rhyme or reason for why we see certain populations in certain areas. It's very difficult to look at the state and say, oh, we expect this phenotype in this region, this phenotype in that region. You see, we have populations of multiple phenotypes right next to each other, basically. So really, that necessitates this local approach to your thrips population. So like I had mentioned earlier, we're getting the thrips that we expect to encounter in our trials by pulling them from seedlings in our trial, or pulling a subset from the population we're releasing in a trial. And because of this lack of real evidence of geographic variability, that's the best way to really understand what you're dealing with. So I'd like to conclude real quick. So first off, and I demonstrated in the field trial, or the greenhouse trial rather, that resistance to neonicotinoid seed treatments that we're seeing in the field, they really manifest themselves as a reduction in the duration of residual activity that you get from the seeds. So because cotton is susceptible in that window from roughly emergence to 4 to 5 true leaves, we rely on the seed treatment to offer control until the plants are old enough to withstand thrips damage. Now, in a resistant population, you have an effectively shorter window, so it's much more difficult to get everything to line up just right. Second, the resistance status of a thrips population is very important when you're determining the background or when interpreting the trial. I hope I demonstrated that today. You want to know, how does it respond to thiamethoxam? How does it respond to imidacloprid? And then any results you see make a lot more sense. Finally, like I had mentioned earlier, just because we see resistance to one AI, that is not predictive of resistance to another. Yes, 54% of our populations are cross-resistant, but we see a roughly 11 to 12% resistant to single AIs, or thiamethoxam and imidacloprid only. And then finally, because we lack a real distinct geographic pattern in the phenotype that we see in the field, it really necessitates a localized approach. You need to know the thrips you're dealing with. So just real succinctly, know your thrips, and that's going to be the best way to better determine how your trials shake out. All right? So thank you to everyone up here. Various support, both financially and with labor. And that's all I have. So if there are any questions, I can take those now. Sir.
When Lev Hoffman was introduced some 25 years ago, they said then that it was not killing thrips, but it was reducing damage and it was reducing reproduction. Have you done any kind of measurements along reproduction lines or damage of plant line rather than counting adult thrips or survival rate?
Right. So we have some data in a separate series of product or separate projects that look at the effect of imidacloprid on the entire life history of the thrips. And like you said, with the imidacloprid, we do see some effect on reproduction, some anti-oviposition effects, and there's also some direct lower mortality. So at least at this point, we're working on getting it published. It's under review right now, but the best we can tell, it's a combination of oviposition suppression and then direct mortality on any larval thrips that happen to be ovoposited on an imidacloprid-treated plant.
Any more questions? We have time. Thank you very much, Father.
Yes, Jeremiah.
Any thoughts on how you implement a management strategy if you know your thrips population beforehand? How would you implement that?
Right. So an example I could think of is, as we see failing seed treatments, there's renewed interest in basically post-emergent sprays. Right now we see acephate as the primary one. And I think if you know that your population probably will not perform well against a seed treatment, then you would be more apt to, you know, get out there and do a foliar spray at the correct time. Now, the future of acephate is always up in the air, so it might be a different AI, but I think that's how you could best inform managerial decisions with that knowledge.
Any more questions? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.